Clytus, I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
Is that war rocket Ajax? To bring back his body?
Everybody, and welcome to War Rocket Ajax. This is the internet's most destructive comic book and pop culture podcast. We're your hosts. My name is Chris Sims, and I feel great. With me, as always, is my co-host Matt Wilson. Matt, how you doing over there, buddy?
A little froggy.
A little concrety?
A little froggy fresh, who has apparently retired, very sadly. But he's making R&B pop music now. I watched a video where he was like talking normal. Instead of in the Froggy Fresh slash Krispy Kreme voice, it was disconcerting.
That's our hot new segment, Froggy Fresh Update, everybody.
That's right.
That's what we do on this podcast, right, Matt?
That's right. No, what we do is we talk to professionals.
And that's very true.
A lot of times we talk to comic book professionals. Mm-hmm. But this week we're doing something we've done a little bit of in the past. We're talking to a game design professional, specifically the designer of a brand new role-playing game called StarCrossed, which is seemingly super fun. I haven't had an opportunity to play it yet. It's brand new and not even on Kickstarter yet, but will be very soon. Alex Roberts is going to be talking to us about the design of that game and a lot about LARPing.
Yes, I have questions, and many of them get answered in this episode. But before we get into that, Matt, we've got a lot of show to get through. This is our first regular format show in a month.
It is. So there's a lot to do, including thanking a lot of new supporters on Patreon.
That's right, Matt. These are the people who have hopped into a taxi, into a Lyft, into an Uber. They have punched the destination into their phones. They have said, hey, take me down to 397 Gimmick Street, because I want to head over to patreon.com and give those War Rocket Ajax boys as little as a dollar a month to help them keep the lights on and pay those gimmicks they keep sending in the mail called bills.
Here are the people who have helped us out since way back before the last time we did a normal episode.
Way back when I had the red and black lumberjack with the hat to match.
Ty Stafford.
Oh, thank you, Ty.
Jason Nassi.
Jason, thank you.
Perhaps Nassi. Peter Velez.
Thank you, Peter.
And Samuel Gardner.
Thank you, Samuel.
So not a huge, huge list of names, but a pretty sizable list of names. If you would like to join that list, you can do so by going to patreon.com/warrocketajax and donating as little as $1 per month to make sure that this show continues, to make sure that we keep doing 2 hour per month Every Story Ever specials, to make sure that Snack Situation keeps coming into your feed if you subscribe to Movie Fighters, and all the other cool stuff we do. Subscribers on our Patreon get ad-free episodes of all those shows, bonus content. We just did a bunch of bonus content from the conventions that we went to. I'm going to be talking very soon about an event that's going to engender a lot of bonus content and other cool stuff. Our new t-shirt is going to be coming out very soon, within the next 2 months, I believe. We've already got the idea for the t-shirt in the chamber. So if any of that sounds cool to you, please head on over to patreon.com/warrocketajax and hit us up with some funds. Chris, it has been a while since we have done any checks and wrecks, so let's do some. So come on and check yourself before you wreck yourself. Chris, what are you checking in with this week?
Matt, it's been so long since we've done one of these regular format shows that I had time to start a new podcast.
You did, and I listened to the Zero episode and was enchanted by it.
Really? Oh, thank you so much. The podcast is called Apocrypals. And if you've listened to Sailor Business or Xena Warrior Business, it's pretty much that, except for the Bible. It's me and Benito Sereno. We are reading the Bible, all of it, But not in order. We're skipping around. We're starting with the Book of Acts, which is going to be out. It's actually out right now as you're listening. We update on Sundays at 10:05 because that's when you get church content.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And we're going to be going through, I think our next book is Daniel in the Old Testament. And then we're going to come back and do some of the Apocrypha for Acts, which is we're going to be talking about the apocryphal Acts of Peter and Paul. But yeah, it's a podcast of Benito and me reading the Bible. And if you listen to the Zero episode, we explain why. But basically, I was talking to Benito on the phone as I was driving home from somewhere. And I talked about the apostles for some reason. And then I started trying to name them, and I could not. Because I had all those names wrong. Except one. I got a...
The one that has my name.
Matthew. I got Matthew. That's your name.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the thing about not being able to name the apostles. There's 12 of them. There's only like 6 names.
That's right.
There's 2 Simons. There's 2 Matthews, because there's a Matthew and a Matthias.
This is the one that's Buckwild. Uh-huh. There are 2 Judases.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. There's 2 Judases. There's Judas and Jude, which are both Judas. We just call one guy Judas so that we know it's who it is.
There are 2 Simons.
Mm-hmm. Simon the Zealot and Simon Culpeter.
Yeah, there are 2 Jameses.
There's James the greater and James the least, less.
It's a strange list. I will say, I feel like Benito, for sake of calling him a name I'm sure he's never been called before, was being a little pedantic. And telling you that the apostles you were naming were not apostles. They were. They just weren't the original 12.
Well, yeah. Well, look, there is a difference between the evangelists and the apostles. And if you want to hear all about that, believe me, we're going to be going into it. But so far, it has been a very fun show to do. I will say this. Matt, I've been doing this show for 9 years. Apocrypals Episode 0, which is available on your feed right now. It's the one where we go through our history with with a particularly Southern brand of Christianity, was the first podcast I have ever edited. Ever.
Yes, I can attest to that.
Matt, I just want you to know I appreciate you, buddy.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks, buddy.
I appreciate you and Jake Mason and Allison Stock so much, more than I can ever say.
I will say that Zero episode of Apocrypals sounded good. You did a good job.
Yeah, thank you. But yeah, I'm doing my best. It did take me, when we did Acts, which had about a little less than 2 hours raw recording, it did take me a day to do the whole thing, and that was only 2 voices. I don't know how you do this show every week.
I don't have an answer. I just do it.
It's just magic. Just get that magic touch.
The longer you do it, the less time it takes. That's all I can tell you.
Well, good. But yeah, check out Apocrypals. APocrypals, Apocrypals, like Apocrypha, but for pals. We've got, right now, I think the art that's up there is a classic picture of Saints Peter and Paul. But Jordan Witt did some fun art for us where Benito is a bishop and I am a snake handler, which is very fun. So if you like it, give it a listen. If you like this show and you want to hear me talk about Jesus times, then give that one a listen. Matt, what have you been up to for the past 3 weeks?
Well, mine is not about the past. My check is about the future.
Ooh, future. And like, yes, like the far off year 2000?
Yes, all the way to the year 2000. No, what I'm talking about is the year 2018, specifically the month of May. The weekend of May the 10th through the 13th, or I guess that's more than a weekend. That's like a Thursday through a Saturday. We are going to be attending our first ever podcast festival, our first ever podcast convention. We've been to a lot of comic conventions, but we have never done a podcast festival. That is changing. We are doing one this year in Columbus, Ohio. We are doing the Columbus Podcast Festival. Our show is on the Friday of that festival, which is May the 11th In the nighttime, I believe we go on at around 9 p.m. Is that right, Chris?
Yes.
But currently, you can buy tickets for the Columbus Podcast Festival on Eventbrite. I will put a link to where you can buy tickets in the show notes. You can buy tickets for the entire weekend, or you can buy them just for particular days. As I mentioned, we are on Friday. However, I would strongly suggest buying tickets for the entire weekend, because on Saturday, you are going to see some other guests that are going to be there. Justin and Sydney McElroy are going to be doing their podcast Sawbones on Saturday. So I would say, if you're fans of the McElroys like we are, you're going to want to see both Friday night and Saturday night at the Columbus Podcast Festival. Just wanted to give everybody a heads up about that. It's one of the only times we've ever been in the Midwest doing any kind of Ajax thing.
Yeah. I got two things about this, Matt. Number one, I got to see Sawbones when I went to the Candle Night show back in December. It was the first time I had ever listened to Sawbones because, look, it's difficult to keep up. That family has a lot of podcasts. But it was one of the, like, funniest things I've ever heard live. It was an absolutely great show. It made me an instant fan. So yeah, Sawbones is a hoot. The other thing, I guess I should, we really need to get out in front of this right now. It has been pointed out to us several times that Which One Vapes is a McElroy bit.
Okay, we don't do Which One Vapes. We do Doohee Vape.
We do Doohee Vape.
And I believe Doohee Vape predates Which One Vapes. We've been talking about Doohee Vape for like 2 years.
None of this is going to stop us from launching Vaporblade LLC. I will say that.
We're never not launching Vaporblade LLC.
It's the knife you can vape.
We may or may not make Doohee Vape a regular segment of the show because, you know, if it is similar to Which One Vapes, which is a McElroy thing we didn't know existed, then we won't do it. But we have been talking about Doohee Vape for a long time.
Yeah. So I just wanted to let everybody know we are aware of this. It's a lot of parallel thought going on in this world. No disrespect intended. But I do want to ask you if did we talk about Crash Bandicoot already?
We did. That's in the bonus content. You got to go dig up the bonus content to find that.
The other thing that I wanted to mention about this podcast festival, and this is going to be of interest to Patreon subscribers and potential Patreon subscribers, Matt, we're not getting on some aeroplane.
No, we're not
heading to Columbus. We're road tripping this bad boy.
We're going to be in the car driving to Ohio from my house in lovely Asheville, North Carolina. So we're going to have a lot of car time. We also have plans to visit a place that we have talked about at length on this very program, Jungle Gems.
Hell yes. Hell yes. I am excited about it. I'm sure we will be, like, if there is ever an occasion that will lead us to have hours of content, it will be you and me in a car together for about 12 hours.
Yes. Yes. And we're going to be doing some snack situation-y type of stuff, I'm sure, where we're going to be trying, you know, Skyline Chili and that kind of thing. So lots is going to happen at PodCon, the Columbus Podcast Festival, which I think PodCon is its own separate thing, so we should stop calling it that.
I do want to say From the Pizone to the Pathrone is one of the funniest things you have said in your entire life.
Well, it did not get a lot of attention on Twitter.
I stood up in real life.
But we have gone from the Pizone to the Pathrone, and we're going to be there. And in the same headlining role, basically, as a McElroy podcast, which is very daunting and intimidating.
We're going to breeze through it. It's no problem.
We're going to come out best friends with Justin McElroy. He's going to be like, hey, do FMV quests with me. And I'll be like, great. He'll be like, hey, let's go to Sheets and get something. I'll be like, I want to see the thing you got at Sheets. It's going to be wonderful.
Yeah, exactly how it's going to happen.
Chris, let's make some recommendations. What do you have to recommend?
My recommendation, Matt, continuing the theme, my recommendation is a podcast that you can get on your internet telephone. or on a computer with a web browser, if you would like to hear it.
I would love to hear about it.
It's called Cocaine and Rhinestones. And I believe you were there when Chad Bowers, my frequent collaborator of the past 10 years, recommended it to me. It is a podcast about the history of 20th century country music. If you have ever heard You Must Remember This, a really great show by Karina Longworth about the history of 20th century Hollywood, I would say Cocaine and Rhinestones is very, very similar to that, but for country music. So, like, maybe 20 times wilder. I think it has a special place in my heart as someone who is Southern, as someone who already loves country music, specifically of the kind that's being discussed on the show, because it's a lot of older stuff. There is an episode entirely about one Merle Haggard song, which should give you an idea of what you're getting into if you listen. In fact, there's a three-part episode on Harper Valley PTA. Which is extremely choice.
There's a lot to mine in that song.
Yes. But it's really good, really informative. Tyler Mahan Coe is the host, and I believe he is the son of David Allen Coe, country music star. The first episode is good. The second episode about the Loretta Lynn song that got banned because it was about the birth control pill is fine podcasting, like very, very choice. So I would absolutely recommend it. It is well worth your time, and it's a really fun and informative show that covers a part of pop culture that is not often accessible. There's a lot of country music biographies and a lot of country music stuff out there, but a lot of it is already like written for people who are already into it. You know, people who grew up listening to Randy Travis, like me.
It speaks the lingo.
Yes, but this is extremely accessible and extremely compelling. If you're a My Favorite Murder fan, there's a true crime episode. If you're not a My Favorite Murder man, maybe skip that one. It gets really brutal. Absolutely give Cocaine and Rhinestones a listen. I got a warning on my phone that it was too full to send a picture to Matt the other day because I had just loaded up so many episodes and I hadn't been listening to anything else for about a week. So absolutely check it out. Cocaine and Rhinestones.
Chris, I think you just invented a new podcast called My Favorite Murder Man.
That's a format that we could play with. Yeah. That's what we're going to do at the podcast convention, I think. Let's look, great artists steal, and we are the greatest of artists.
It's true.
Matt, what's your rec this week?
My rec is also a podcast.
So many!
Which I have been mainlining. I have been listening to this podcast. I am like 15 episodes deep. Chris, you considered originally calling ApocryPals good Christian fun.
That was a Benito's suggestion, I think.
The problem was there was already a podcast called that.
Mm-hmm.
Almost immediately after you said that, I got a recommendation from my friend Ben Fowler to listen to that show because he said it was very good. So I was like, the universe is telling me something. So I found Good Christian Fun and I started listening to it, and it is fucking great.
It really is. I've also been listening to that one, and it's fantastic.
The basic premise of the show is the two hosts, Kevin and Caroline, who are delightful people, who are also themselves Christian, but are not like proselytizy Christian. They're like normal people, right? They cuss, they joke around, they're funny. They invite on a guest who may or may not be Christian to watch some kind of Christian entertainment or listen to an album. They could also possibly read books, but most of what I've listened to so far is either an album or a movie. Or in the case of Bible Man, like a direct-to-DVD kids show. They'll watch it, they'll talk about it for a while, they'll decide whether that entertainment goes to heaven or hell. They'll give it a holy toast or a holy roast. And then they have segments that they do after that, which I find extremely fun. Definitely the best of which is the hunt for the worst Christian song of all time. Because, Chris, we've talked on this show many times about Christian entertainments and our fascination with them and searching for some of the worst examples of it. Like, we did the Christmas – worst Christmas mixtape of all time years ago on a Christmas episode.
That had
a number of Christian songs on it. They did, over December, the worst Christmas song of all time, where they kind of like did that segment, but specifically for Christmas songs. I think two of the songs we picked for the Christmas mixtape were involved. Christmas with the capital C was definitely on there. I don't think they did Where's the Line to See Jesus, and I think I need to send it to them.
Oh, you might, because that is a extremely bad song.
There are already places to go see Jesus or interact with Jesus. They're called churches.
It's like very specific.
Anyway, the songs for like the worst Christian song of all time segment, I've really loved. There's one called Cartoons that you just have to listen to, but that should have stayed on top of that segment forever. It got dethroned at one point, and it should have stayed on top forever. But I like a lot of the other stuff that they do as well. They've talked about some of the movies we've reviewed for Movie Fighters. They've done the first Left Behind movie. They also did Kirk Cameron's Saving Christmas.
Did they get as head up as I did about the end of that movie?
They didn't go into like fucking theology like I did about the consumerism stuff.
That's like Apocryphal's episode -1.
Yeah. But they did, you know, they had a similar reaction to the theological bent of that movie. So I would very much recommend checking out that show if, like me, you grew up at least in the orbit of Christian entertainments. It's very, very fun to listen to. And not preachy and not sort of anti-religious. It sort of exists in a space of they're just having a good time. They're not trying to make anybody feel bad, and I really appreciate that.
Yeah, it's I can absolutely co-sign that rec, because I before I got onto Cocaine and Rhinestones, that was what I was mainlining. I didn't know Katy Perry was a Christian artist back in the day.
You talking about Katie Hudson?
I am talking about Katie Hudson.
Chris, that's going to do it for our checks and recs. Let's talk about some comics that came out either this week or in the recent past. Chris, we got to talk about DC Metal #6.
What, Dark Knight's Metal?
That's what I'm talking about. We had a particular request to discuss specifically 10th Metal. And what a wild ass concept that is.
It's, here's the thing though, it's not. 10th Metal makes sense. That's the wild thing.
It certainly follows.
Like
from everything that has come before in that series.
Benito posted, like, somebody asked him, like, what his, like, favorite DC crossover was, and he was like, yeah, look, the only good DC crossovers are Invasion, Final Crisis, and Metal. He's not wrong.
And Metal certainly harmonizes with Final Crisis, right up to the end.
Almost like it's resonating with the vibrations of a 10th Metal.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the thing. A thing that I like about Metal is when we read comics that we don't like, it's often – it's not a lack of realism. It's a lack of internal consistency that gets us.
Yeah.
Metal is completely internally consistent. Metal is straight up and follows a logical conclusion to saying, hey, this is the 9th Metal, and here's the other 8 Metals. And then goes, oh, by the way, there's a 10th Metal. Like, of course there is. That's how numbers work.
And we have to share the 10th Metal with everybody in the universe. Put a little bit of 10th Metal in everybody to defeat the overarching great demon evil that's trying to take over our world.
Will there be a better line in comic books in the year 2018 than we're all a little metal?
It's going to be tough. It's going
to
be tough.
Real tough to be that bad boy. Yeah, I also like Batman's Victory Party.
Oh, yeah. the thing about metal is it throws all these curveballs at you, right? All these wild concepts like the Joker Dragon. But you're not wrong about it, the story itself having a complete internal consistency.
Yeah. Everything, like, everything follows logically. Like, if this is true, then this also must be true. Like, there is, you can draw a line through it. I also, like, I really love the end of the Batman Who Laughs, and I love the thing where it's like, oh yeah, like, he's not the Joker, he's actually, you know, he's Batman.
He's Bruce Wayne. They're all Bruce Wayne.
Oh, it's extremely
good. And the notion that, yeah, the one thing Bruce Wayne wouldn't expect is for another Batman to team up with the Joker, so that's what happens.
Yeah.
I think what it is metal doesn't spend a lot of time teeing you up for stuff. It just says, here's the next thing.
Yep. And you're like, uh-huh, that makes sense.
But it had the next thing logically follows from the last thing.
Yes.
You're just not necessarily, like, prepped for it.
Can we talk about the Joker's bat-shaped straight razor, though?
I mean, that's all that needs to be said about it, is that it exists.
Yeah, it that's a thing. That is a thing. It's great.
Yeah, I mean,
I love it.
We loved metal. Like, that's all there is to say about it. We loved metal.
Yeah, very much so.
All right, next let's talk about Marvel 2-in-1 number 5. This is the series that Chip Zdarsky is writing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there all this hay has been made in the past week, and rightly so, that Fantastic Four is coming back in a new series. But this has kind of been our under-the-radar Fantastic Four series, you know, for months now, for 5 months now. This book by Chip Zdarsky, the art in this particular issue is by Valerio Schiti. I think that's how you say the name. Because what we get is Ben Grimm and Johnny Storm going to these different universes trying to find Reed and Sue.
Yeah.
Like, they're trying to find their own Reed and Sue.
Yeah, it's Ben and Johnny looking for Reed and Sue. That's I got to count it, but let me see. Yeah, that's four. That's the Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
In this and issue...
There are a Reed and Sue in this issue. They're just Reed and Sue of a different universe.
Now, Matt, would you like to explain to the people how this universe that they end up in differs from the old 616, or shall I?
Well, I'll give a piece of it.
Okay.
So, you know how the 616, the regular old Marvel universe, it's got a Doctor Doom.
Talk about the Eighth World.
That's the one, yeah. It's got a Doctor Doom.
Yes.
Currently, that Doctor Doom is Iron Man.
Yep.
He's an Iron Man.
Right.
And it's got a Galactus. This universe, they're one.
Mm-hmm.
The Doctor Doom is the Galactus.
Yes. Rather than the FF defeating Galactus, the FF fucked up real bad, and Doctor Doom showed up and defeated Galactus by becoming Galactus, and then ate the rest of the universe.
Yep.
And so all that's
left is Earth.
All that's left is Earth. And now Doctor Doom, Galactus, is coming back with an army of silver Doctor Doom heralds to eat this Earth.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. And I did not mean that as a pun, but it is accurate. It's wonderful. Chip's so funny that it's really easy to forget that he's really fucking good at doing superhero comics.
Yeah, like...
frustratingly so.
This is, like, one of those big comics ideas that I'm shocked hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. And it's, like, also perfectly up our alley. Like
yeah.
It's right for the Chris Sims-Matt Wilson intersection of a comic called Marvel 2-in-1 about Ben Grimm going to a universe where Doctor Doom is Galactus. Like, we could not have asked for it better.
I mean, it's also got a scene where Ben Grimm literally slaps sense into Reed Richards,
mm-hmm.
who's, like, moping around because he screwed up.
Yeah.
And basically saying, hey, we all screw up. We've all screwed up. We gotta fix things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very inspiring and good, and I love it.
Yeah, man, it's got all that good Marvel that we like.
All that good Marvel. It makes me so happy that Chip went Marvel exclusive. Like, not that I think necessarily Chip should be exclusive to anybody, but Chip gets the Marvel shit.
Yeah,
for sure.
He, like, again, he's been making jokes about it for so long that, like, you did not expect that dude to roll up and, like, suddenly be like, oh, hey, here's, like, the best Fantastic Four story in 5 years. Well, I guess since Secret Wars. So, 3 years, yeah. But still.
Since Hickman was doing Fantastic Four.
Yeah. Quite good.
Yeah, super good. All right, one last comic we're going to talk about is a digital first series.
A digital get down, we like to call it.
Yes, this issue is Suicide Squad Hell to Pay number 3.
Yeah, this is a Jeff Parker Suicide Squad joint that you might be missing because it's a digital first thing. And the reason I mention it here now with this third issue, first of all, it's the first time we've done comic book reviews in a month. But also, if you were a fan of like Secret Six, this is a Jeff Parker Suicide Squad story where Bane's on the team. And they're going to get Scandal, Savage, and also Knockout is there. So, you know, the team that you like from those comics is kind of getting back together, with maybe not the writer who was the writer of Secret Six, obviously, Gail Simone, but with a writer you like, Jeff Parker, doing some good stuff in that book. It's super fun. I really like it. Well worth your time to check out digitally and presumably whenever it winds up in print. But, you know, absolutely go get it digitally and give it a read right now because you will enjoy it.
Who is the artist on this particular issue?
Is it
Matthew Dow Smith?
Yes, it's Matthew Dow Smith doing the art.
Okay. And I didn't realize this. This series is tied into an animated film called Suicide Squad Hell to Pay.
Really?
So it's like a movie tie-in comic.
Well, hey, whatever we got to do, however we got to get it.
That's going to do it for our comics review segment. Chris, now is the time that we are going to talk to Alex Roberts about tabletop gaming, LARPing, and more.
Joining us for the program this week, we are very excited to have a new guest for the show. She is the owner of one of the all-time great Twitter handles. She's a game designer working for Bully Pulpit Games, and she has a new Kickstarter launching this week for a role-playing game called Starcrossed. Alex Roberts is here. Alex, hi, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on.
When I was talking to a mutual friend of ours, James D'Amato, because you are also a podcast host on the One Shot Network.
That's right. Yeah, I do a show called Backstory. It's also an interview show with folks in the role-playing community, sometimes designers and sometimes just other cool, interesting people doing interesting work.
You know what I am only just now realizing is the folly of having someone else who does an interview podcast as a guest on this show.
No, it's not folly. It's the opposite because I'm going to like do all of the things that I love it when my guests do. My guests are all wonderful, 100%, but there are like certain things that they do, right? Like I'm gonna give you clean takes if I like screw up, you know, there's just, it's going to be a premium experience.
Cool. So where do you get your ideas?
No, that's, no,
what did I do to deserve this disrespect?
No, but one of the things that James mentioned when I was contacting him to get me in touch with you to get you on the show is that you have a lot of experience with the world of LARPing.
That's right.
And the reason, the primary reason I wanted to talk about that is I have never in my life engaged in live action role playing. Mm-hmm. However, my main Christmas present to my wife this year was that we are going to go LARPing this summer.
That is good. That is good, and I want you to know that it's very good. Which LARP? I have a guess. I was going to write it down.
You can probably guess. I don't want to say it on the show.
Okay. Cool. But we'll just acknowledge that we both know where you're going, Chris.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good.
I'm sure you do.
Great.
I'm nervous and, like, anxious about it. I'm not on Facebook, but Aiden is, and she says people are, like, preparing. What is, like, best case and worst case scenario that I have signed up for?
Honestly, worst case scenario, it rains on you the entire time and you're, like, filled with regret. Like, no, you know what? Like, screw off. It's going to be really awesome. And I feel like worst case scenario, you'll just be like, well, that wasn't for me, but it's also going to be something that I remember and tell stories about. You know, like, even if it's not something that you go and just become totally devoted to, you're going to be like, that was a unique experience. That's your worst case. Your best case, like, you will be transformed as a person, you yourself. I'm not joking. I am 0% joking. People have some profound experiences with role play because it is all about being someone that you are not. And if you do it long enough, and in my opinion, a whole weekend is long enough, it's possible 2 hours is long enough, you'll realize that you actually can't be anyone other than yourself. You can only be just different aspects of yourself. And then you get to discover that the character that you built was, I mean, I have to be corny here, inside you all along. And whether that character was a horrendous villain or the coolest person ever or actually very gentle and kind or, you know, pretty darn resourceful at the end of the day, whatever it is, you get to find out, oh, cool, I have access to that.
I likewise have never participated in LARPing. I've certainly stood a few yards away and watched as it occurred. One of the reasons I feel like I have not ever felt the desire to, like, you know, jump in is it seems like a very deep well.
Oh, yes.
Where, you know, once you get in there, once you dip the toe in, you can sink to a great depth and meet those people who will be massive proponents of a particular type of LARPing. Mm. While other people, you know, are big proponents of some other kind, and I'm sure there are millions and millions of different variations of it and all that kind of stuff. Like, what would you suggest for someone who's just getting started and has already maybe become overwhelmed by all the different types and options and variations of play?
So I would not necessarily recommend doing a weekend long thing. That wouldn't be my first kind of go-to. It's not necessarily a bad choice. I've met people at what we sometimes call blockbuster LARPs or destination LARPs, where you go somewhere and it's kind of a complete finished experience in 2 or 3 days. That's pretty okay. Then there are LARPs that run like all weekend for 1 weekend a month or something like that. That's probably the worst one to jump into because there are people who've been going to that thing for 30 years, I guarantee you. And like, if you can get into it, it could be very rewarding from what I understand, but like that takes a lot of time. I think if you want to have a relationship with LARP where you see if you like it, and if you like it, you then do it sometimes. My best recommendation to you would be to go to something called the Golden Cobra Challenge. You can find them at, I think, goldencobra.org.
I wish you could see the way my face lit up upon hearing those words.
Isn't it just a little bit dramatic? Isn't it kind of perfect in that way?
Just a shade. Just a shade.
I have no idea where that name came from.
What part of Outworld do I need to take my kung fu skills to in order to compete in this Golden Cobra Challenge?
None. Okay. So it's a design challenge. So this was started by a bunch of people who wanted to do more LARPing at conventions, but found that there were very few kind of like short, easy to jump into games that had very flexible requirements about like number of players and environment and experience level and stuff like that. And so they just made a challenge that was, hey, make a LARP that can be played in under 4 hours with under, I think, 12 people or something like that. And requires minimal props and materials. And so that was just done to just have them as a resource. And then they would kind of judge them and give prizes based on certain criteria, like most convention ready, or like most kid friendly, or most newbie friendly, or whatever. So as a result of them hosting this challenge for a couple of years now, there's now this huge backlog, not only of games, but of winners from every single year. So you can go the past, I think it's they've been doing it 3 or 4 years now, and you get to see the best of what people have made that is specifically designed to be played in a relatively small amount of time with a relatively small investment on your part. And these are things that, like, you can run in an afternoon in your living room, or maybe like at, you know, at your office after hours, or if, you know, if you do go to cons, you can put it on the schedule, get a room or something like that. And they also tend to be super high quality and really good, especially if they've been chosen as one of the winners in the categories. But also more recently, there've been a lot more like sharing. And so people will edit each other's work and play test it and that kind of stuff. So we're starting to see really, really high quality LARPs come out of that. And finally, if 100% all you want to do is like play with a sword and like hit each other and stuff, find your local Amped Guard people. Amped Guard is the medieval fantasy combat crew. They're like a global organization. They have chapters in like seemingly every large city. We have an Ottawa chapter here that is just like total sweethearts. They tend to, they'll have like a once a month or sometimes a once a week meetup where they just play. And if you go as a newbie, they'll be so happy to see you. They'll just be like, okay, here, borrow this sword. And like that guy will show you the ropes and you can, you know, do a couple duels with that guy. And, you know, like generally speaking, LARPers are very happy to have more LARPers in the hobby. So they sometimes, when allowed to by the rule structures of their format, you know, they'll be very welcoming. Certainly in their attitudes, LARPers tend to be very welcoming.
Are there rule structures that do not allow them to be welcoming?
Yes. I wouldn't say, maybe not allow. That was a bit strong. But there are kinds of games that make it easier or more difficult for you to accept new members. So, for example, if you have rules where going often means that your character becomes more powerful within the game, that has a certain financial incentive if you're running your game and hoping to maybe turn a profit. But that creates a problem where then the person who just showed up, you know, they want to participate and they want to be there, but they're not going to get to go and do any of the really fun, cool stuff, and they don't get to have any of the cool equipment. And so it's very easy for folks like that to feel very left out. And even if you have like a welcoming module or something like that, where they can kind of do a little demo of something cool, that can be fun. But then at some point that is over and they have to like actually start, you know, over and start from day one. And it's especially hard if they don't have like friends who are already playing, for example, who can kind of like, you know, scaffold their interest into it. And it depends about your rules about who's in character and when. You know, so if I show up to an activity, for example, and everyone is expected to be in character the instant they arrive, that is going to be so hard for me as a newcomer to navigate, because it's like, who do I talk to? Wait, is anyone here not a vampire and like a person?
You know? The question I ask every time I enter an unfamiliar
place. Yeah, exactly, right? Inquiring minds want to know. It's a very relevant question. So There are systems that make it harder or easier. Absolutely. That is a design challenge, in my opinion.
So do you have any particular stories from your time with LARP that you would like to share?
Well, Chris, it sounds like you want horror stories based on
the... I don't... I don't want horror stories. Horror stories would be fine because I tell the tale that I've been told. Mithridates, he died old. That is the tenet I live my life by. But I, you know, like any like fun stuff. Like, look, I have played a lot of regular like tabletop pen and paper role playing games. I've never had a problem committing to a bit, as Matt well knows.
That's good. Hold on to that. Hold on to that instinct.
But I am like, this is, you know, playing a tabletop game or a pen and paper RPG, you have a built in distance, right? Like I play an online game even with my friends every week. So I'm just seated at the same desk that I sit at every week for Ajax. So this feels like a whole new arena for me. And I gotta know something before I go in.
I'll tell you a couple of experiences. Let me think. I had one that was just, this is a very recent one that was just absolutely like bone chilling, like so good. There's a game out there called Inheritance, which was written by Luke Crane, who pen and paper people might know from The Burning Wheel and Mouse Guard, a couple of other games, Torchbearer. So yeah, he made a live action game that is called Inheritance, and it's about a Viking funeral. So there's this big, powerful Viking family. The patriarch of it dies, and there's a sort of prodigal son who was exiled for killing the eldest son, and now he's back with his bro, who he met in exile, and he's here to claim his inheritance. But of course, everybody wants a piece of the pie. So that's a pretty choice setup for some dramatic interaction. A lot of characters tend to die in a game like that. And what makes it super interesting is that one of the characters is a Christian, like a priest, and he had secretly, oh wait, is this a secret in the, I don't want to spoil it. But anyway, some people have taken baptism. Some people have converted, which, as you can imagine, the Vikings who have not converted, not going to be happy with that situation. Given the time period. So I had this amazing scene where I was sitting with the matriarch of one of the Viking families, and we were having this total heart to heart. You know, me, I was playing the priest, and she had converted in secret and kept it a secret from everyone. And she was very, very worried about her son, and worried that people were going to kill him just because he might have a rightful claim to this stuff. And we also kind of thought that if he did end up head of the family, then we might be able to influence that situation and get everybody else to convert, possibly the whole region because of how influential the family was. So we're having this very kind of strategic discussion, but also, you know, there's a lot of emotion in her character for it. And the matriarch, who is being played by my friend Jeremy, you know, looks at me and says, I'm afraid I'm going to lose another son. It was a very sad moment. And I said, you know, I just kind of went with my character's perspective on it, which was, you know, we're all called to mission, and that may include the glory of martyrdom. And Jeremy looked me dead in the eye and said, if my son dies, you too will be called to the glory of martyrdom. And I was like, oh God.
That is a dope line.
So choice, you know? And Jeremy's not an actor. You know, we didn't have a writer's room, but there was, we just had cooked up this scene such that that was the only thing to say. You know, you put stuff in place, and then when the dominoes kind of get knocked down, it just makes a beautiful pattern. And to me, that was a small moment, right? This wasn't at a big, giant blockbuster event. This was in a conference room at a YWCA. And yet I remember it really powerfully and really strongly. And also a bunch of other players in the room had turned and watched us. And at that point, they were all just like, oh!
That is so much more intense than I was expecting.
Yeah, well, also, I had to give you the good stuff.
Well, now that we've got that good stuff, let's move from the field to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And talk a little bit about Starcross. Now, this is going to be coming to Kickstarter this week, correct?
Yes, that's right. We are set to launch on April 10th. Very exciting.
And what is the what's the basic pitch for the game? How are you describing Starcross to people just to kind of as a basic explanation?
Elevator pitch, it's the two-player role-playing game of Forbidden Love. So you play two people who really, really want to when they really, really can't. Simple as that. I think it's pretty compelling.
Is it a strictly two-player game, or are there also, you know, Mercutios getting involved that are maybe trying to prevent this?
It's strictly two-player at this point. And you really just play the two people, and you play a series of scenes which are really about being in very close quarters. You need to set up a situation where not only are you super into each other, and not only is it not going to happen, there needs to also be some sort of like a reason why you can't just be like, okay, well, bye then. So people, you know, play it on a space station where they're the only two people, or one's a brain parasite inside the other one's brain. That was interesting. Even just stuff like that, you know, it could be anything.
There's obviously a major narrative element to the game. And one thing, you know, when we've talked to other game designers on the show before, we've sort of talked about that push and pull between, you know, getting really heavily into the mechanics and kind of letting the story drive everything and maybe being able to fudge on the mechanics a little bit. What would you say is the balance for Starcross as far as that goes?
I think that's false binary.
Okay.
Yeah,
please elaborate.
I think that's a discussion that really goes nowhere. If you want to fudge the rules and have a good time, like it's your table, you know, nobody's the game police are not going to show up at your door. But every system is designed to do exactly what it does. So if you're playing a game and you're saying, oh, you know, if I just ignore this one rule, this will be such a cool moment. It's possible that there's another game out there that would suit your purposes better, because that game is telling the story. It is giving the narrative that it was designed to tell. It's not less of a narrative design. It's just a different narrative. It still takes you through a feeling, right? If you're playing, you know, fourth edition D&D, for example, and I say fourth edition because I haven't really played around with fifth edition much, but I did play a decent amount of fourth edition. You know, that game does a great job of taking you on a particular emotional journey and telling a particular story. It tells the story of a strategic combat with some minimal stuff happening in between, if at all. And that combat is very long and very drawn out and has a lot of little threads that go nowhere. And the emotional journey really depends on what you bring to it. If you have been waiting all your life for a strategic combat simulator that is totally grid-based and you can like paint your mini and kill a thing, and you want that to take really long because then it's going to be really rewarding in the end, that's your perception of that experience, it's going to be a really exciting story. And if that is not the specific thing that you want, then that doesn't mean that the game is bad necessarily. That's just not the story that you want to be told and to tell. It's not your genre. I mean, there's lots of genres of movies that I don't go see. It doesn't mean they're not telling me stories. It's just not what I'm into, right? So my game is not necessarily simpler than a game that you would think of as crunchy. And it's not necessarily more story focused, but it allows you to tell a story and encourages you and helps you tell a story that is the story of two people who really, really want to and really, really can't. It's a story about romantic and sexual tension. It's a story about wanting to have things that you can't. and being unable to say as much as you want to say. And there are ways that I can reinforce that as a designer. But to me, it's not about crunch versus story, or you can ignore this part of my game because, you know, it's kind of free form. Like, no, I personally, as the designer, I think you will have the best possible experience if you follow every single one of my instructions to the letter. Now, it's possible that someone will play my game and be like, I'm not having a great time with this. Can we ignore this part? Do it up. I will not break into your house and take your game away as a result. But it's possible that you should play it with someone else, play it on a different day when you feel a different way, try playing it with a different setup, you know, or just go play something else.
I think that there's something that fascinates me about game design, which is a field that I have zero experience with, but obviously I am keenly interested in as a consumer. Maybe this is just me. I was about to say writers like me, but maybe this is just me. I have a fundamental distrust of my audience.
What does that mean to you?
I find it very hard, even while acknowledging that, like, the audience is, you know, by necessity has to complete the story. Like, the intent that I bring to it is only completed when it's interpreted by an audience. Like, as much as I recognize that, a thing that I enjoy about writing is that I get to control everything. Like, I get to control the dialogue. I get to control the setting and the narrative and the plot twists and how every aspect of it goes, which is, you know, like, for me, in comics, working with a collaborator like I have with Chad on so much stuff, or even working with an artist, that's as much control as I am comfortable ceding. But I feel like with game design, you have to have a level of trust in your players that I don't, like, I find very daunting.
That is such an interesting perspective, because as you're describing the level of control that is very important to you, to me that sounds like an illusion. And
you're probably absolutely,
like,
wow, correct.
You don't really control, like, pretty much anything. You don't even control what you're saying. Really, you know, control, but that's my perspective. And maybe that has to do with being more of a designer. Although I've done lots of writing for games and other stuff, to me, being a game designer, you have to, like, acknowledge the illusion of control, or at least I highly recommend you do so. And then you get to embrace the freedom of that. Right. And so instead of saying, okay, I need my players to do this exact thing, so I'm going to tell them A and B, and I believe that they will figure that out and do C. Like, you know, there's some of that because I have to write a rules text in a way that I need them to, well, I'd like for them to interpret in the way that I interpret. But letting go of that allows my game to be something that is honestly greater than what I could make myself. And the stories that other people have told with my game are greater than the stories that just I would tell if I just sat down and played my game forever. My gosh, people have told me about games that they played that were just not at all what I intended the game to do. And I think I need to embrace that, or I think I'm happier and more balanced as a person if I embrace that. I mean, one of these days, someone's going to come along and tell me about a game that I just can't get into. And that will be challenging. That will be a challenging moment. And I guess that just hasn't happened for me yet. But for the most part, I remember the first time that somebody played my game and used it to make fan fiction. I was running it at a con for these two dudes who had never met each other before. And I sat them down at a table and told them that they were going to fall in love. And for some reason, they decided to create kind of a fictional barrier between the two of them that was, or, I mean, at least that's my interpretation of that creative choice, which is not necessarily what it was, that they were going to be Anakin Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi, and they were going to explore some of the feelings that those two may have had for each other. And they told this really silly, really cheesy, kind of over-the-top, sexy slash fic. And it was very good. It was super fun. They had the time of their lives. It made me laugh. It was a great story. And I had not only not used StarCross to do that before, I think I may have specifically said, this is not a slash fiction game. Like, I don't want people to make slash fiction with it. And yet when it happened, I was like, okay, well, you got me.
Well, I think by virtue of the fact that, you know, Chris and I are both writers, it's our inclination is to focus on the storytelling part of these types of games. Mm-hmm. But I'm also very interested in the tools that get used to tell the story. Because, you know, from what you've said so far, you know, I just very much get the impression that two people sit down, pick two characters, and then start talking to each other. I mean, is that more or less the extent of it? Or is there some kind of mechanical element that the players are using?
Yes. So that's the fun thing about StarCross. There's a tumbling tower of exactly 54 equally sized wooden rectangular blocks sitting in between the two of them. And I mean, I don't know. I don't like going into every single thing because it's excruciatingly boring for the listener. But there are very specific answers that you questions. There are very specific questions that you answer in a specific order, each of you, at the very beginning of the game. And these are things like, what has brought you together? What is keeping you apart? What is your most attractive feature? What are two things about you that you don't realize are attractive? Why can't you act on your feelings? Why is that important to you? And you go down a line and answer those in conversation with your partner. And then you take a series of 8 scene cards and you flip over the first one and you read what it says. And then you do role play a scene that is based on that. However, that role play consists of taking turns doing one of the moves that's listed on your sheet. And those moves are, you can either on your turn describe your character's movements, describe a detail in the character's environment, describe your character touching the other character intentionally, describe your character doing that unintentionally, describe your character revealing something personal intentionally, or describe them doing that unintentionally. Now, those last two, the revealing and the touching, those two increase the attraction between your two characters in such a notable way that you have to pull a brick from the tower and put it on the top. Now, at some point...
This is delightful.
At some point, this tower will probably fall. And when that happens, and never before it happens, your characters act on their feelings. So they in some way make tangible and make known and make obvious their feelings for each other in a way that they cannot take back. So exactly what that looks like, I mean, whether they're declaring their love or grabbing the other's hand or jumping into the deep end of something in some way, it just has to be obvious and it has to be irreversible. Obvious to the two of them, maybe not to anyone else in the room. So it really depends on where your characters are in that particular moment when that tower most unexpectedly falls. But what you end up with is a very, very, very constrained set of exchanges, right, that feel very loaded because they're very restricted and that give you, the player, the feeling of not being able to say everything you want to say. Because, of course, if you want your character to give any dialogue on top of these moves, you, the player, have to be touching the tower while you speak. So early on in scene 1, 2, 3, you can do that semi-confidently. You can kind of prattle on a little bit. But by scene 8, I mean, these are going to be hushed whispers that, you know, are basically going to consist of, I can't do this, you know. They're going to be as dramatic and concise as possible because you really, really don't want to be touching that tower for longer than you have to. So there, it is actually specific and also complex in the sense that I've very carefully removed a lot. And I have only the only exactly what needs to be there is there. It's sort of like, you know, when you see one of those kind of strange, like hyper contemporary architectural projects and you're like, how does this stay up? That I think is the complexity of my project.
I'm glad we got there. I feel like we may have buried the lead.
A little bit, right? Oh my God. It's so funny that I don't even, I gave you my elevator pitch and everything. I forgot to put the tower in it. That's some classic good marketing.
Well, I would love to dig into that even more, but Chris, I think we got to move on to Twitter questions.
That's right, Matt.
Oh my goodness.
Our tower has fallen, and now is the time of the show where we turn it over to our friends on Twitter. And Matt, if the listeners out there want to get in on these chats that we have each and every week for almost 400 episodes now, how can they go about that?
Well, Chris, it's easy to do. The first thing that you need to do is acquire a computer or a smart telephone. And upon doing that, sign up for an account on twitter.com. Then when you sign up for that account, you know, get your name right and everything, and then tweet your first tweet, which is obviously, can't wait to get tweeting here on Twitter. Then your second tweet.
Everybody's first tweet, verbatim, that.
Yeah, they don't let you in unless you do that. So
then your second tweet is obviously, hey, quick question, everybody here on Twitter, please retweet, please like. Is anyone here not a vampire? And just see what kind of responses you get. I'd be interested to know. Report back to me what people say. Then for your third tweet, wait until Thursday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern time. That's 6:30 Pacific time. And watch out for either myself or Chris putting out the call for questions for our guest. And that will be your opportunity to make your third tweet, which will be a question for our guest, just like these questions you're about to hear for Alex. And our first question from Twitter comes from your friend and mine, James D'Amato.
Oh boy.
At One Shot RPG, who has a question for all three of us, actually. James wants to know, what comic characters would make the best star-crossed scenario?
Ooh. Well, Alex, you are a guest. You, by all means, should go first on this one.
I have one, and it's extremely good because I just very, very, very much enjoyed reading Gengoro Tagame's My Brother's Husband. So, have either of you heard of, Tagame's work in general?
I have a copy.
Oh, really? Okay. It's really, really good, right?
I haven't read it yet because I, like, as regular listeners know, I have not read comics since 2013, judging by what we talk about on the show. But I'm hoping to dive into that pretty soon. It's on my stack of to read stuff.
That's totally okay. I keep up pretty sporadically. But anyway, so Gengoro Tagame is this well-known, extremely groundbreaking, and incredibly talented manga illustrator who is sort of like the epitome of the Bara style, which means that he draws these big buff gay dudes having like really hardcore BDSM sex. And he's super good at it. Like you look at his illustrations, you know, which have had like gallery showings and everything. And you're like, what's happening is not necessarily what I want to be happening in real life, like to me, because it looks like that hurts very badly. But my God, the draftsmanship, like the line, like his line work is just next level. So anyway, kind of an interesting figure. He decided to make this like heartwarming slice of life manga called My Brother's Husband, which is about this guy who's a single dad. And he hears out of the blue one day, someone that this guy from Canada named Mike gets in touch with him and says, "Hi, I'm your brother's husband, and he just passed away." And like the guy and his brother had been estranged for a really, really long time. He knew that his brother was gay. He came out as a teenager, just privately to him. And then very shortly after he left, and guy honestly didn't know where he went. So now he's an adult. I mean, I think it's implied they're like in their 30s, 40s. And he has to kind of figure out like, oh, like what happened with my brother there? And also now I have to mourn this person that I feel now like I barely knew, but was also super important to me. And the husband, Mike, says, you know, we had always said that we would go to Japan together. And we had this like really specific trip planned out and everything. So I'm actually going to come to Japan and do this trip sort of like in honor of him. It would be really cool to meet you. So they meet, and the guy's daughter is like, oh, you have to stay with us because you're my uncle. And the last time our other uncle came to stay, he stayed with us. So that's what should happen. The little girl is like a great character in the comic. It's this like very sweet story about this guy confronting his own homophobia and being like, I loved my brother no matter what, so therefore I can't have any like negative attitudes. But then he sort of realizes like, oh, there are like a lot of shitty assumptions and like weird attitudes and stuff that I had. And I get to see now in a way that I didn't see with my brother, like this is how stuff like that affects a person. And they have these interesting conversations about like homophobia in Canada versus like homophobia in Japan and how it's different. And, you know, he has to like explain all this stuff to his daughter that it becomes clear that he would never have talked about. And he's like, oh, why wouldn't I have ever talked about that stuff? And it's really cute because the guy is Canadian. So he's talking about all this Canadian stuff, which I love to see in a manga. And this is why it's great. It's not implied that the two are necessarily going to hook up. But because it's Gengoro Tagame, they're both super buff and sexy all the time. Like, not even a way that's like really my thing. It's very much like the gay male gaze on these two dudes, where they're having like normal conversations and stuff and doing family drama, everyday life things, but they're just big and buff and being sexy. And every time, like it really is a very emotionally complex comic, but every time they have like a, whew, oh no, that was a really, really intense moment I just had there. You know, that was a very serious conversation. You know what? I better hit the shower. Like they have these really long bath scenes that are like 3 pages long for no reason. And it's very well drawn. So honestly, if you're looking for star-crossed comic book inspiration, hit up Gengoro Tagame's My Brother's Husband. Also just read it anyway, cause it's very nice.
Matt, do you have one?
Yeah. Mine, it requires little explanation. It's Spider-Man and J. Jonah Jameson.
Mine is J. Jonah Jameson and Robbie Robertson.
Oh my God.
Yes.
I gave such a serious answer.
Well, look, I appreciate that answer. That has made me like way more excited about reading My Brother's Husband, which I got a while back. And again, I've been working through this pile for a while. But I mean, like I was thinking of characters that have unspoken tension.
Yeah.
And it's got to be Jonah and Robbie for me.
I mean, it's got to be Jonah and Spidey for me, because you know Jonah's hate is just hidden love.
I have to side with Matt. Definitely. Definitely.
He does want pictures.
Oh my God. Boy, does he want
pictures of
Spider-Man.
Listen,
Peter, I have a very important assignment for you, but you really can't tell anybody about this.
Peter, sit at this table. Sit at this table with me in front of this big tower. Here's a question from RJ Edwards at RJ Makes on Twitter. RJ wants to know, in playtesting Starcrossed, have players who are real life romantically involved had a different response to the game than players who aren't? I'd be interested to hear how the game plays differently for friends versus couples, or strangers for that matter.
What's interesting about the playtesting process is that when I have playtested it myself, like with me in the room kind of a thing, that's usually been either with friends or with total strangers, because I'll do it at conventions or, you know, at a friend's place or something like that, where there's like a big gaming thing happening. But when I did one round of external playtesting, so like I don't get to be there, I'm not in the room, and you just send me like a questionnaire afterwards, that was mostly couples, as far as I know, like people who were involved romantically. People, that's a weird way of putting it. Difference. So the differences that I noticed might just be like a product of like doing the testing in two totally different ways. I think, and yet honestly, like I don't think I could give you a trend. Like there are things that I thought would happen. Like I thought, okay, you know, people who don't know each other will like keep it pretty light and silly, and they won't do any serious themes. And people who already know each other really well, those are the ones who are going to go for the deep, kind of really like maybe even a bit taboo stuff. That is not true at all. People went buck wild with this game with like pals and strangers at a con. Like they would use examples of things that I would say as like, well, you probably don't want to do this. And they would do it, which is amazing. And then couples would send back more things like that that were cool and were super interesting and I enjoyed, but that didn't give me that kind of what the fuck response. And so I think that says a lot actually about how willing we are to be open with strangers when we have the correct alibi, because that's actually way less loaded than being super open with someone who you are in a committed relationship with, right? You have so much invested in how like a partner perceives you versus like how this person that you just met at a con perceives you. You're like, well, I can suggest this, and if they think I'm like gross and awful, like, eh, well. But like if that's your, you know, if that's your partner in some way, like that, the consequences of that can feel pretty heavy, pretty extreme.
Yeah, I could imagine a scenario where you might feel more open with a stranger than with someone you know really well. The only thing I know for sure would be in games between couples, existing couples, that would not be in games between strangers, is weird coded stuff about things you do at home. Like, oh, I have to reveal something about myself? I leave my socks on the floor.
Well, the hope is that these would be sexy things, Matt. Or not sexy, but ones that would, you know, sort of increase the intimacy rather than quite sharply decrease it.
All right. We are running out of time here, so we're just going to do one more question. No. This is from Robert Secundus on Twitter. Robert wants to know, or says, it's fascinating that you were inspired by Dread, that similar mechanics could work equally well for horror or romance.
Yeah,
how do you see the relationship or overlap between horror and romance?
This is a great question. Yeah, so the first game, as far as seemingly any of us know, to use the tower in an RPG was Dread by Epidiolab Ravichal, which is a super well-known game, groundbreaking, very well-regarded, possibly because it's extremely fun and good. And to me, it didn't, like... To me, it seemed like such an obvious fit. It's kind of hilarious. I remember reading about this study once where participants performed a task and then they were given some information by a graduate student. And then the graduate student was instructed to be like, oh, and if you have any other questions, you know what? You can totally just reach me at my home number too. And so the student would give you a phone number. And of the participants were in two groups. One of them just performed like some math problems or something. And the other one did something that was like kind of dangerous. They had to like cross this bridge. Like they weren't going to get hurt, but it kind of felt like maybe they might. But it was actually totally safe, but it felt scary. And the of the participants who did the scary thing were significantly more likely not only to call the research assistant, but also to ask them out on a date. And I think that's because physiologically, our fear reaction, right? The you know, little moistening of the palms, a little quickening of the heart, maybe even a little shaky hand if it's very intense. Like, that's also an arousal response. I mean, it literally just is physiological arousal. And so whether that's good or bad really depends on our interpretation of the situation.
Is a wonderful way to close this out. Our guest has been Alex Roberts. Alex, before we let you go, can you tell everyone where they can find you and Starcrossed online?
Absolutely. So if you're reading this before the 10th, you know what? Just follow me on Twitter at Muscular Pikachu, or follow Bully Pulpit Games. We're at BullyPulpit_HQ. And if it's after the 10th or on the 10th of April, you can just go straight to Kickstarter.com and search for Starcrossed. It's the two-player game of Forbidden Love. It's illustrated by Jess Fink. It's going to be the best game ever made. Sorry to all other games. You were very good. Sorry.
Alex Roberts, you have been a wonderful guest. Please come back and talk to us soon. And thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me and putting up with my verbosity. This was very fun.
Thanks once again to Alex Roberts for joining us. Absolutely. Go check out Starcrossed. But in the meantime, Matt, why don't we get a little Starcrossed ourselves? Not with each other, but with this question that you're about to ask from our listeners.
Well, we'll see if the stars are crossed for it or if they line up perfectly.
What a complicated segue.
This is a listener question sent to us on Tumblr from The Velez, who has a very simple question for us, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
They want to know, is Flash Gordon a superhero?
No.
Would you define Flash Gordon as a pulp hero?
I would describe I would define him as an adventure hero, for sure. But not a – I would say, yeah, he comes from a different tradition than how we would define a superhero.
I think it's really hard to define a superhero by – abilities, because not every superhero has superpowers.
Right.
I think it's really hard to define a superhero by what they wear, because superhero costumes come in many, many shapes and sizes.
Mm-hmm.
I think you have to go to the tradition they emerge from, or sort of the moral compass that they go by. Even though I guess there are plenty of superheroes who have that, like, pulp hero moral compass where they're fine with killing too.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to draw the line the more I think about it.
Related question that I think is going to help shed some light on this one. Would you consider the Shadow to be a superhero?
No.
Absolutely not, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though so much of the Shadow is like in language that was translated directly to superheroes through Batman.
Right, but there's a moral difference between the Shadow and Batman.
And I think there's a traditional difference between the Shadow and Batman, too.
Yeah. Here's what mucks up Flash Gordon for me, being a superhero or not. Okay, so if we say Flash Gordon's not a superhero and is instead a pulp hero, what does that make Adam Strange?
Adam Strange? I wouldn't call Adam Strange a superhero. Because he's a very concerted attempt to create a pulp hero within the confines of a superhero universe.
Okay.
But he is himself, Adam Strange does not fit in the Justice League.
Yeah.
I like him. I like him when he shows up. I like that Jeff Parker Justice League Unlimited book that Adam Strange and Alana were a part of a lot. But that dude does not fit in with the JLA. He's a different thing, very clearly.
Okay. What about Star-Lord?
Star-Lord like Peter Quill?
Yeah.
I think that depends on which version of Star-Lord.
Yeah.
Because keep in mind, like, the Star-Lord that we have now, like Chris Pratt-looking Star-Lord, is not original Star-Lord or weird 90s Timothy Zahn Star-Lord.
No, they're... Don't forget about that, dude. There are many, many different variations on Star-Lord. That is absolutely true.
I would say Star-Lord now, like post-Annihilation Star-Lord, let's say. I would say that dude is a superhero, but a very Marvel Comics superhero.
I mean, he's a very Marvel movie superhero.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like even before the movie, like circa Annihilation, he's a superhero, but he's a specific kind of superhero that is endemic of the Marvel Universe.
Okay.
Right? Like, I
can buy that.
He's a very... There's a certain put-uponness to him, I guess, that is a part and parcel of the Marvel Universe.
There are definitely versions of Star-Lord from before that who are more superhero-y.
Mm-hmm.
Who you can look at and say, oh, that's a superhero.
Yeah, certainly weird Timothy Zahn Star-Lord.
Yeah, yeah.
Is more superhero-y.
But like, you know, earlier versions of Peter Quill certainly had a more immediate, like, oh, that's a superhero looks. Yeah.
I mean, he absolutely comes from the Marvel tradition, right? Like, that's yeah. The closest touchstone we've got to that dude.
The thing about Flash Gordon is, if you were to just look at him with no context and see him with the flash on his shirt and a lot of the trappings that come with him,
mm-hmm.
He looks like what you would call a superhero now. But it's something about the types of stories that he's in, where his enemy is, you know, this horrible space emperor, that put him more in that pulp tradition rather than, or maybe it has something to do with like who he associates with, the characters that are around him.
I think it's easier to draw like a line from Flash Gordon to like a tokusatsu hero. Because of the like the differences in what they do, right? Like Western heroes, like your Supermans and Batmans, have rogues galleries. They've got multiple villains,
And they fight crime.
They fight crime as like evil as a concept. Your tokusatsu heroes, your Kamen Riders, your Super Sentais, they have one evil organization that all of their enemies are tied to, generally speaking, like Shocker or the Zodiarts in Kamen Rider Forze or you know, Bandora, Rita Repulsa's people in Power Rangers. Like, there is a specific and defined villain that is closer to what you get with Ming the Merciless, right? Because, like, Flash Gordon ain't out there, like, you know, stopping muggings, which is not necessary for a superhero. There's certainly a difference in purpose, I think, that comes from the language.
Yeah, and there's something to be said about, like, Flash Gordon gets thrown into a situation that's sort of out of his control.
Mm-hmm.
And just has to kind of roll with it.
He does roll with it. He rolls with the changes. He's like Ario Speedwagon.
He's exactly like Ario Speedwagon. As opposed to like, you know, exerting control over a situation and making a choice to fight a particular evil or bad guy or whatever. I don't know. It's very hard to define. I think our answer ends up being, is Flash Gordon a superhero? No.
Well, I also think it's very much a, like, we get variations on this question a lot. Like, is Hellboy a superhero? No. Like, is, you know, is Buffy a superhero? Maybe. But, like, there is a definite I'll know it when I see it aspect. Yeah.
Superheroes are exactly like pornography.
Yep.
I know them when I see them. However, if you tried to argue with me that Flash Gordon was a superhero, I wouldn't dismiss it out of hand. Like, I'd hear you out.
I would hear you out, but I think, like, at the end of the day, my answer would just, like, there's no evidence I could present to you to convince you and I don't think there's any evidence you could present to me that would convince me. I'd just be like, no, he's not.
It's a very blurry line. It's a very blurry line. And I know that's not the definitive answer necessarily that the Velez wanted, but it's the answer they're getting.
Hard no for me.
Mine is no with a shrug and a question mark.
And that is the difference between Chris Sims and Matt Wilson.
If you would like similarly nuanced answers to your questions, then send us a question on our Tumblr, which is warrocketpodcast.tumblr.com. You can also send questions to our email address, which is warrocketpodcast@gmail.com. That email address is also where you can send every story ever lists, panel president lists, or if you want to sponsor the show, you can let us know there, or you can otherwise just get in touch there, drop us a line. Check out our website also, warrocketajax.com. That is where you can stream the show, download the show, read show notes, and leave comments. Also, head to your favorite podcast app, whether that be Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Podcatcher or whatever it is you use, and leave us a review. We haven't gotten any reviews in a while, folks, and the more reviews we get, the more we are featured in different places on those apps, the more that we get our name out there. And, we can stand to grow this show a little bit more. So please leave us a review if you like the show. We would appreciate it. Now we've reached the part of the show where we tell you all the different places you can find us online. For me, all you have to do is go to mattdwilson.net to find links to all my stuff, my other podcasts, my books, my comics, and my social media presences. They are all right there. Chris, where can people find your stuff?
People can find my stuff just by going to the-isb.com. There's links there to all the other podcasts that I do, all the columns that I write around the web, and the comic books that you can purchase online at Amazon or at your local comic book store. Sword Quest is out in paperback now, has been for a little while. Very, very proud of that one. Me, Chad, Scott, and Josh, all very pleased with how that one came together. So if you haven't read it, now is the time to jump on that one. This is the time. That is the place. These are the voyages. Please give it a read.
Okay. One last thing before we get out of here. We mentioned it last week on the show, but it was after 2 hours of talking about WrestleMania. So I don't know how many people heard it. William Mester Lopes is a comic book writer and occasional artist who is going through some difficult times and who needs some help. You can help him out by going to a GoFundMe called the Severe Weather Network. I will put a link to that in the show notes, but it is just GoFundMe.com/severe-weather-network. That is where you can donate to help not only William Mester Lopes, but also help people in the Oakland area get housing and fight homelessness, which is what William Mester Lopes is currently enduring. So you won't only be helping a comic creator who's going through a hard time, but helping others in the region where he lives to do much the same, to find somewhere to live. And it's a good cause. It's something that people have been sharing a lot lately. And also consider, while you're helping William Mester Lopes, also helping up other comic creators who are maybe not in the news right now, but are also dealing with difficulties, including Bill Mantlow and any number of others. Just keep those people in mind. There are comics creators who do all this stuff to support and make these stories that we love, and we should not let them just go unremembered and let them suffer with illness or with other troubles. We should help them.
Yeah, we've mentioned it before as one of our good causes, but the Hero Initiative is always a good place. They're always on the lookout for people that can help. They're a good organization that many comics creators have benefited from and that many comics creators vouch for in terms of supporting. So if you're not sure where to go to help people out that have made comics and been a part of this medium and that we love and all these great stories. The Hero Initiative is always a great place to start. But for William Messner Loebs in particular, the Severe Weather Network, absolutely check that out. And if you can, if you've got the ability, give a little back to the guy that Mark Waid called his favorite Flash writer. You know, like that's the high praise for someone who did a lot of really great stories.
All right. That does it for War Rocket Ajax number 397. As we careen closer to episode 400.
What will happen?
Can you survive the world of 400?
Are you ready for the world that's coming in War Rocket Ajax 400? No, you're not. Ask and answer. Well, ask and answer, baby.
Well, I can tell you this. 396 was S rank, and it was HQC. Can you imagine the HQC of 400?
Can you imagine how H that QC is going to be?
But we got 398 coming next week first. We'll see you then.
Hey, sneak preview, HQC.
Bye, everybody. We love you.
Yeah! Flash.